From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A new biography reveals that John F. Kennedy's health was far worse than many of us imagined. He had colitis, osteoporosis, Addison's disease, sinusitis, and urinary tract problems. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Robert Dallek, author of An Unfinished Life, about Kennedy's health problems and how they were covered up, as well as new information on Kennedy's extramarital affairs and his presidency. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg takes a look at a new documentary on the National Spelling Bee and has some thoughts on the value we place on spelling. And critic Milo Miles considers the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival now in its 34th year. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Authorities in Victoria, Texas, say they've arrested a man believed to be the driver of a tractor-trailer where 17 bodies were found today. An 18th person died in the hospital and one remains in critical condition. Officials say the trailer was abandoned at a Texas truck stop with about 60 people crammed inside. They'd apparently been smuggled across the border from Mexico in the overheated, badly ventilated trailer. District Attorney Dexter Eves says the survivors are being regarded as victims.
I want to make sure that we get every ounce of justice for these people that's coming their way. And whether that's through the federal government or through the state government, it matters not to us. We want to make sure that that's done properly for the ultimate victims.
The Department of Homeland Security is helping in the case. The new Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement has announced a top 10 list of most wanted criminal aliens. The agency says it's stepping up efforts to deport tens of thousands of foreigners convicted of serious crimes who've then defied orders to leave the country. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
For years, thousands of convicted aliens have served jail time and then, before they could be deported, disappeared through gaping cracks in a system that couldn't track them. Now that the U.S. Immigration Agency is part of the Homeland Security Department, officials say they're better placed to prevent this. Undersecretary Asa Hutchinson says immigration officials have access to more sophisticated computer databases of the former customs agency, and customs officials, he says, have expertise in tracking fugitives, having gone after those involved in drug trafficking and child pornography. Hutchinson says his agency will double the number of teams tracking criminal alien fugitives. It's also created an 800 number for tips from the public. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
The Bush administration says Saudi Arabia needs to do more in the war against terrorism, but the president's spokesman declined to criticize Saudi security measures following this week's bombing in Riyadh, which killed 34 people, including 7 Americans. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The most critical language from the administration on the bombings has come from the ambassador to Saudi Arabia, who complained in a TV interview that the Saudis had not provided the added security the U.S. requested. Later, Press Secretary Ari Fleischer noted that Americans and Saudis died in this week's attacks.
And certainly once a nation is victimized by terrorism, it does have the effect of making that nation reassess and reexamine everything it had done up to that point. Obviously, until they were hit, they thought what they were doing may have been at a sufficient level. We're constantly working with nations around the world, including Saudi Arabia, to urge them to focus on the threat.
And Fleischer said the focus should remain on catching those responsible for the bombings in Riyadh. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
In stocks, the Dow lost 31 points to close at 8,647. The NASDAQ lost 4 to close at 1,534. This is NPR News. 51 Democratic lawmakers from Texas remain in an Oklahoma motel where they're protesting a Republican redistricting plan that would cost them seats in the state House. Their absence has prevented the Texas House from establishing a quorum, which prevents it from debating the redistricting bill or any other legislation. Texas Governor Rick Perry, a Republican, accuses the Democrats of causing a partisan disruption. The Democrats say the problem is the fault of U.S. House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, accusing him of trying to force the state to accept a redistricting plan that will give Republicans an unfair advantage. A Belgian lawyer has filed a war crimes complaint against the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, General Tommy Franks. Douglas Baction reports from Luxembourg City.
Lawyer Jan Furman lodged the complaint in a Brussels court on behalf of a group of Iraqis whom he describes as victims of alleged U.S. attacks on civilians. Furman said there is material that shows the U.S. came into Baghdad, and in the first 2 days, American forces were firing at anything that moved, including women and children. Washington rejects such charges. The action comes under a controversial Belgian law that allows Belgian courts to try foreigners for war crimes. Complaints have been filed against leaders, including Yasser Arafat and Fidel Castro, but they have not come to trial. Furman is from a leftist party and is running in Belgian general elections to be held in a few days. The U.S. State Department has said Belgium should be careful to prevent abuse of its legal system for political ends. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Luxembourg City.
In stocks today, the S&P 500 lost 3 points to close at 939. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR online shop now features a selection of portable, shortwave, and classic AM/FM radios at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. New information about John F. Kennedy's political career, as well as his health problems and extramarital affairs, is revealed in the new biography, An Unfinished Life, by my guest Robert Dalek. Dalek is also the author of a 2-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. In researching the JFK biography, Dalek got access to newly uncovered medical records, which show that Kennedy misled the public about the extent of his health problems. Those problems included colitis, Addison's disease, headaches, upper respiratory infections, urinary tract problems, and osteoporosis, which caused his constant back pain. The osteoporosis was probably a side effect of the steroids he was given as a young man to treat his gastrointestinal problems. Was Kennedy concerned when he was running for president that his health would stand in the way of being an effective president, of being able to do the job?
Well, Kennedy made a bet that he could, so to speak, that he could function effectively as president. Now, there was a cover-up of his health difficulties. Between 1955 and 57, for example, there were 9 hospitalizations for the various ailments I mentioned. The public didn't know about this. They knew he had back surgery at the end of 54 and had a plate removed from his back in early 55, but they did not know about these 9 hospitalizations, one of which lasted for 19 days, 2 of them lasted for a week, several of them for 2 or 3 days. So they hid this from the public, but he was confident that he could function effectively as president. And in fact, he did carry it off because it was one of the things I looked very closely at in my research. I wanted to see, were all these medicines that he was taking having any negative impact on his ability to be lucid, to function effectively in this office of such great power? And I looked at the Bay of Pigs crisis. I looked at the Cuban Missile Crisis. I looked at the Berlin Crisis when Kennedy and Khrushchev were jousting over the question of access to Berlin. And there were dangers of a war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union over that. And what I found was that Kennedy was consistently lucid. And we, of course, have the tapes that he recorded, and particularly during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you see he's very much in control, very much on top of the issues that he has to confront. So my conclusion is that he really did not demonstrate any effect from taking these medicines. In fact, if he didn't take them, I don't think he could have functioned as president at all.
You say during the presidential campaign he was followed around by an aide with a medical bag. What was in the bag?
Actually, my medical colleague, Dr. Jeffrey Kelman, and I had a list of the various medications that was in the bag. It was antispasmodics, antibiotics, hydrocortisone, antihistamines. My medical colleague said that if he took all these many medicines that were in that medical kit at one time, it would have killed him. Of course, they were there in case of an emergency. At one point in the campaign, the medical kit was lost, and Kennedy called up Abe Ribicoff, the governor of Connecticut, and said, "Abe, this medical kit I carry with me has been lost," and essentially he said it'll be a disaster if it falls into the wrong hands. Well, it was found, but it demonstrates how anxious they were to hide the problems, health problems he had from the public.
Now, you found that Bobby Kennedy requested that the autopsy report be destroyed after JFK was assassinated. Tell us what you learned about that.
Well, this is all part of the cover-up of JFK's medical difficulties. After JFK died, the FBI came to a man named Herbst, who was Kennedy's urologist, and they asked him for the files. And Herbst said, well, I can't just give you the files. I've got to speak to the family, to Mrs. Kennedy, to Robert Kennedy, which he did. And Robert Kennedy told him to destroy the urological files. And the Herbst's son called me and told me that he remembers his father and grandfather, who were both urologists and in practice together, going down in the basement of their house and throwing the files into a furnace. At the same time, there was a White House physician by the name of Young who told me that he believes Robert Kennedy instructed the White House physician, Admiral Berkeley, to destroy his records. And then when the autopsy occurred, Bobby Kennedy ordered that the autopsy notes, not the autopsy itself, report itself, obviously, but the autopsy notes be destroyed, because obviously he didn't want the public to learn about his brother's many medical difficulties.
Robert Dallek is my guest, and he's the author of a new biography of John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. Well, you have new information on the affairs that Kennedy had while he was in the White House. Before we even go there, why did you want to know? I mean, what is the importance to you of knowing that?
Well, I did not do an awful lot with the philandering. There's been so much written about it. And so I didn't spend an awful lot of time on this, but I did, in the course of my research, come across the fact that JFK was having an affair with a 19, 20-year-old intern, a college student who would come down to be an intern at the White House in the summer, and Kennedy would take her away on trips with him. And as my source said, she had absolutely no skills. She could answer the telephone, except, I guess, to have sex with him. But what's most important about all this, it seems to me, is the fact that the womanizing did not detract from his public performance as a president.
What did the FBI know about his affairs, and what did they do with that information?
The FBI knew a great deal about his affairs. There are lots of materials in the FBI documenting Kennedy's philandering and keeping J. Edgar Hoover closely informed. Robert Kennedy and John Kennedy understood that Hoover had this information, but they had a kind of unspoken alliance. Kennedy kept Hoover on in his position as director of the FBI, and Hoover held back from revealing any of this information. In fact, Kennedy had an affair with a woman named Ellen Romisch, about whom there was suspicion she might be an East German spy. It's never been proven, but you didn't need proof of this. If it became public, it certainly would have been a shattering business for Kennedy's hold on the public's imagination and on his political credibility. But Hoover sat on this information. They sent Ellen Romisch out of the country. And so there was a kind of blackmail, one might say, that the FBI, or Hoover in particular, could have used against Kennedy if Kennedy was going to try and dump him. By the same token, Kennedy had a hold over Hoover because Hoover served at his pleasure.
So things stayed in neutral on that regard.
Yeah, so there was a kind of mutual agreement that one didn't, that the Kennedys would not push out Hoover, which they might have liked to, and Hoover did not reveal what he had in his files.
What about Kennedy's political enemies? Did they try to leak information or to expose Kennedy?
Well, I think on the health material, on the knowledge about his health, they did try and reveal this material, but not on the sex, you see. His political enemies were very cautious about doing this, because Kennedy, I think, had pretty good information about what the sexual escapades were of some of his political enemies, and so it could have been a kind of mutual mudslinging they engaged in. But on the health, during the 1960 campaign, Lyndon Johnson's campaign tried to get the public alerted to the idea or the fact that Kennedy was ill, that he had Addison's disease. And the Kennedys bristled at this revelation and angrily denied it. Of course, Johnson was right.
And one of the things I learned quite recently is that the night before John Kennedy was nominated, Lyndon Johnson called up a physician in Los Angeles, where the Democratic nominating convention was being held, and said to him, Dr. Labaner is the man's name, Gerald Labaner. He said, Dr. Labaner, I understand that you've been saying that John Kennedy has Addison's disease. And Labaner told me that he was nonplussed by Johnson's call and he would not answer him directly. He had been gossiping about this, but he knew that this was not appropriate for him to reveal it, and so he wouldn't tell Johnson directly that Kennedy had Addison's disease. So I think it was on the medical that they tried to get Kennedy so politically, but not on the sexual.
Well, didn't you find that Nixon may have tried to steal Kennedy's medical records?
This is speculation on my part, I should say right off the bat. There was a break-in and an attempted break-in of Kennedy's physician's offices during the 1960 campaign. Kennedy himself thought it might have been J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI. The whole thing, though, to me, has the smell of Watergate and the break-in of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Beverly Hills. And so I have speculated that this could have been the Nixon campaign trying to get this information about Kennedy's poor health. The office of Dr. Eugene Cohen, who was Kennedy's endocrinologist, the files were put in a different drawer under a different name, and so the break-in did not result in any information being obtained. And Dr. Janet Travell's office, they tried to break the lock and didn't succeed and never got into her office. So Kennedy was protected from the revelations about his health problems.
Robert Dalek, you report a lot on Kennedy's health problems. You also report in your new book on Kennedy's infidelities. When you think about the two together, you have to ask yourself, if Kennedy had back problems, colitis, urinary tract problems, headaches, other issues too, how did he manage to have so much sex? I mean, honestly.
Yes. It's a good question. A lot of people, Terry, a lot of people ask me that. And as far as I know, there was, first of all, the procaine shots in the back, so that one can imagine that he was free of pain during a sexual encounter or a sexual performance. The other is that there apparently was a lot of sexual activity in the White House swimming pool, and water gave him buoyancy and would relieve the back problem, during the sex act. And then also I've been told and read that he would take the prone position, which would not put the kind of stress on his back, I guess, that he otherwise would have experienced. So maybe those are the answers to that question. But, of course, I'm not absolutely sure, and I don't know that we'll ever learn exactly. Of course, there is a 500-page oral history that Jacqueline Kennedy made and is locked up in the Kennedy Library and will not be opened until 50 years after her death. I asked Caroline Kennedy Schlossberg for permission to read this oral history, but she replied politely that her mother's wish was to keep it closed 50 years after her death, and she feels compelled to honor her mother's wishes.
My guest is Robert Dalek, author of a new biography of JFK called An Unfinished Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Dalek. His new book, An Unfinished Life, is a biography of John F. Kennedy. Let's talk about JFK's involvement in Vietnam. You say that he wanted the French to end their colonial rule of Indochina, and he also wanted to save Indochina from communist control. Did you get any new understanding of how he ended up getting more involved in Vietnam under Kennedy?
Yes. It's a very interesting story, Kennedy and Vietnam. there's no question that in the 1950s he saw French colonialism in Vietnam as destructive to Western interests, to French interests, to American interests, to the whole anti-communist struggle, because French colonialism was fanning the flames of expanding communism and was encouraging communist insurgencies, not only in Vietnam, but in other colonial countries. Kennedy hoped the French would get out of there. He hoped that the regime in Vietnam would then be duly, freely elected, that it would be pro-Western, that it would achieve a kind of stability and would be firmly in the anti-communist camp. Of course, as it turned out, the French wouldn't leave and were forced out by their defeat at Dien Bien Phu in 1954. And then the country was divided into two parts: North Vietnam, controlled by Ho Chi Minh and the communists, and South Vietnam under the rule of Ngo Dinh Diem, who was a Catholic ruling a Buddhist country, who was pro-Western and pro-American, and the Eisenhower administration gave him both financial aid and military equipment. And when Kennedy came to office in 1961, there was already some 650 American military advisors in Vietnam helping the South Vietnamese to resist this insurgency. Kennedy, after the defeat at the Bay of Pigs and all the tensions he had with Khrushchev over Berlin, was keenly concerned about the Third World. This was a period in Cold War history when you had a fight for what was described as hearts and minds, when the Soviet Union was appealing to Third World peoples with the idea that America was a racist society, they had segregation, apartheid in the southern United States, that the Soviet Union would bring them a much more rapid economic advance, progress, equality, a place in the world. And Kennedy was deeply concerned to assure that America would win out in this competition with third world countries. He sets up something called the Green Berets, which is a counterinsurgency force, because he's fearful that the way the communists are going to advance in Vietnam and other third world colonies is by subversion, by using guerrilla tactics. He also feels the need, because the South Vietnamese government is so ineffective in combating communism, Kennedy felt the need to send in or escalate or increase the number of military advisors from some 650 to 16,700. And so by the end of his presidency, we had a more substantial commitment in Vietnam than we had at the start of his term. However, my conclusion in my book is that Kennedy never would have escalated and become as deeply enmeshed in Vietnam as Lyndon Johnson did. Different man, different time, that there would have been a substantial difference between the two of them.
So what do you think the fundamental differences between Kennedy and Johnson were about Vietnam?
Yes, this is the most important part, Terry. John Kennedy was deeply skeptical of the American military. From the time he served in the Navy, he saw the military chiefs there as in many ways incompetent, acting in unwise fashion. And then this was confirmed for him in the Bay of Pigs operation when he was told by the CIA and the military that there'd be an uprising in Cuba. And afterwards, he reproached himself for having allowed the invasion to take place, saying, "How could I have been so stupid?" He, at one point, wrote Bob McNamara a note after the Cuban Missile Crisis in which there was still a discussion of invasion plans. And he said, "Bob, the invasion plan is very thin. If we go in there, think of the nationalistic fervor, think of the technical capacity we'll meet. Think of the experience of the British in the Boer War, the Russians in the Russo-Finnish War of 1940, of our experience in North Korea. We could get bogged down." Now, if he's worried about getting bogged down in Cuba, you can imagine what he thought about Vietnam. He said repeatedly that it was not a good idea to send large numbers of American ground forces into Vietnam. And in fact, he instructed Robert McNamara to begin planning an American exit from Vietnam. His last conversation with his Assistant Secretary of State, Michael Forrestal, November 20, 1963, about Vietnam, Kennedy said, "We have to review this whole problem before, after I come back from Texas, and we have to include in this, we have to consider how to get out of there." Kennedy did not want to escalate in Vietnam. The press, his dealings with the press, were very important here. Lyndon Johnson hated the press because it was demoralizing the country in the war. Kennedy disliked what the press was doing because it was reporting our ineffectiveness in resisting communist aggression in South Vietnam. And Kennedy was worried that he was going to be pushed in the direction of escalation. He was concerned to keep Vietnam off the front pages of the newspapers. And my supposition is that if he had been reelected, which he certainly would have been in 1964, he never would have escalated to the extent that Lyndon Johnson did. Another comparison. Kennedy had credentials as a foreign policy leader, having succeeded in the Cuban Missile Crisis, having put across the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty in the summer of 1963. He had the credentials to say to the public, "We do not have to fight in Vietnam." Lyndon Johnson did not have those credentials. He was very apprehensive that if he didn't take a stand in Vietnam, the communists would see him as weak. He worried about the domino theory, as it was called, about the toppling of the dominoes in Southeast Asia. He held the Munich analogy in mind that if he didn't fight this smaller war, it would lead to a larger one. And so two different men, different times, different outlooks. And I think the result would have been quite different if Kennedy had lived.
Robert Dalek is the author of a new biography of John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Dial Press, a division of Random House, publisher of On the Nature of Human Romantic Interaction, fictional stories by Carl Jan Yema. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more on Kennedy and the Vietnam War. We continue our conversation with Robert Dalek about his biography of JFK. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the original American game show, The Spelling Bee, and Milo Miles reviews the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Robert Dallek, author of a new biography of John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. Dallek is also the author of a two-volume biography of Lyndon Johnson. When we left off, we were talking about Kennedy and Vietnam. You say Kennedy wanted to keep Vietnam off the front pages of the newspapers. Did he try to control the press?
Yes, without question. he tried to get David Halberstam, who was the New York Times correspondent in Saigon. He tried to force the New York Times to remove him from Saigon. We remember David Halberstam now as the author of The Best and the Brightest and as something of a an anti-war exponent. But in 1962-63, Halberstam was an advocate of a more effective American effort in Vietnam. The book he published in 1965, The Making of a Quagmire, argued the case for the idea that the United States should not lose Vietnam, that we should make a more effective effort to succeed there. This bothered Kennedy a great deal because he saw Halberstam, as the New York Times man in Saigon, in a position to force this issue onto the public's consciousness, and he wanted to remove Halberstam as a consequence. May I take up one other point about all this?
Sure.
People have said to me, well, but could Kennedy have gotten out of Vietnam? Okay, maybe he intended to or he wanted to. We'll never know, of course. It's counterfactual history. But could he have done it? Well, look at the polling data. The Gallup polls, 1961, 62, 63, there were no Gallup polls on Vietnam. The first Gallup poll I found was in April of 1964, and the public was asked what they knew about Vietnam, and they said only 37% said they knew anything about Vietnam. A year later, April 1965, after Johnson had begun the bombing of North Vietnam, the campaign known as Rolling Thunder, Americans were asked what they thought the outcome would be in Vietnam in 5 years. Only 22% said they thought it would be an American pro-American government there. The 45% said they thought it would either be a neutralist or a pro-communist government. In the summer of 65, after Johnson had escalated the war by putting in announcing he was going to put in 100,000 ground troops, the public was asked again what they thought the future of Vietnam would be, and a majority said that it would end up like Korea, that there would be a kind of a stalemate or a neutralist arrangement there. So the public was not invested in the idea that we fight and win Vietnam. And it seems to me in 64, and even more importantly in 65, when Kennedy would have been starting his second term, there would have been the opportunity for him to get out of Vietnam.
What are some of the things that you think might have been different, in addition to Vietnam, had Kennedy lived and been reelected for a second term?
If Kennedy had been reelected to a second term in 1964, I think he would have carried into the Congress with him very substantial majorities of the sort that Lyndon Johnson had with his victory over Goldwater in 64. And I think Kennedy would have put across all the domestic legislation that was later folded into the Great Society under Johnson. Remember that civil rights and the federal aid to elementary, secondary, higher education, Medicare, Medicaid, the war on poverty, departments of transportation and housing and urban development were all JFK ideas. These were all on Kennedy's agenda, and they all were realized during the Johnson presidency. But if Kennedy had been reelected, these measures, reform measures, I think, all would have been passed and would have become part of the Kennedy record. I think 100 years from now, people will look back on the Kennedy-Johnson administrations. They'll be much more folded into one, and they'll see the domestic achievements as not simply Johnson's and certainly not simply as Kennedy's, but as an amalgam of what the two men did in the presidency.
Now, you write that in 1988, 75 historians and journalists described JFK as, quote, the most overrated public figure in American history.
Yes.
Why did they reach that conclusion, can you say?
Well, because when you ask the public, and there was a recent poll, again asking the public, who are the greatest presidents in American history, John F. Kennedy came in second after Abraham Lincoln. In these many years since his death, This question has been asked repeatedly, and repeatedly John Kennedy ranks in the top three or four. And of course, on the face of it, it simply seems unpersuasive. After all, he served for only 1,000 days, the sixth shortest presidency in the country's history. And so professional historians looking at this take their distance and say, well, he's the most overrated president in American history. Where would Kennedy rank if, in fact, he had lived and had a second term? I think he could have ended up as someone on par with Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson and Harry Truman, that is, in the rank of near great presidents. Of course, we'll never be able to say because this was cut off and he only served 1,000 days.
You write that John F. Kennedy was worried about the radical right. What people, which groups was he worried about?
Well, there was a vigorous right-wing movement, the John Birch Society, for example, in the United States in the 1960s. It was fiercely anti-communist, fiercely opposed to expansion of federal authority in the domestic sphere. It was all right with the right wing if you built up the American military. Purposes of defense were legitimate in their eyes, but they were decidedly opposed to any kind of expansion of domestic authority or federal reform activities. And so Kennedy was very worried that the right wing in America, which had a significant following, and was a lot of them were based in the South and in Texas, and could stir up all sorts of hostilities between the United States and the communist countries. And he felt compelled to rein these folks in or to keep them from being too boisterous and too vocal in their agitation of the anti-communist issue. Barry Goldwater was their darling. In 1964, remember, Goldwater said things like, we ought to think about lobbing one into the men's room of the Kremlin. And this had huge appeal to people on the extreme right and the people in that John Birch Society.
Was the extreme right out to get JFK?
Oh, without question, the extreme right despised him, thought he was that he betrayed American interest, that he didn't invade Cuba in 1961 and topple the Castro regime was a sign of weakness. And in the John Birch Society, which was full of paranoid speculation and paranoid thinking, that Kennedy was maybe pro-communist. I mean, they said the most outlandish things about American leaders. Remember, you had a history of McCarthyism in the 1950s and this right-wing anti-communist hysteria, evangelism, one might say, and they despise Kennedy.
My guest is Robert Dalek, author of a new biography of JFK called An Unfinished Life. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Robert Dalek is my guest, and he's written a new biography of John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. Having written the biographies of two presidents, do you find yourself wondering what information will be revealed about President Bush 10, 20, 30 years from now? How will his presidency, how will his life read differently than it does now?
Well, it always reads differently, and we, of course, learn a great deal more than we knew at the time. This is the historian's function to, and that's why we're so eager to preserve records, and be they emails or printed materials or telephone conversations, if that's possible, because we want to get at the actual workings of a administration. Ronald Reagan's presidency, for example, we still are nowhere near getting the full presidential record. How much was Reagan in control? How much was he on top of various issues? He claimed a kind of ignorance over Iran-Contra. Is this accurate? will in time learn, I believe, from the internal workings and records of that administration, and in time will learn a great deal more about the inner workings of the Bush administration and of the Clinton administration from the records that come to hand 20, 30, more like 40 and even 50 years from now.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think new regulations under the Bush administration have made it more difficult for historians and biographers to get access to certain information. Certain information will be locked up for a longer period of time. Why don't you kind of explain what that's about?
Well, the President Bush has issued an executive order which allows presidents and vice presidents to hold back on revealing presidential materials in perpetuity if the family chooses to keep them closed. Lots of historians, archivists, journalists, and members of Congress protest is a violation of the Presidential Papers Act of 1976. And this is being contested in the courts, the president's executive order, because it will have a chilling effect on the ability of historians and biographers and journalists to obtain materials about a presidential administration even 40, 50, 100 years from now. This is a constant problem that historians struggle against. Abraham Lincoln's papers were held by the family and did not become available until 1947, and Lincoln had been killed in 1865. So this is a primary concern that historians have.
Give me an example from the Kennedy book of personal papers that you got access to that with information that you think it's really important that the public know.
Well, the material on Kennedy's health. There were the Janet Travell files that had been at the library for almost 40 years, or ever since the library had been opened. Biographers had asked access to these materials in the past, and they had been denied. I requested permission, and there's a three-member committee that had control over these papers, and the committee agreed to open them to me. It took something like over 2 years, 2.5 years for me to gain access, which I was very pleased. And then when I went to the library with a medical colleague who helped me read and understand the medical materials, we were startled by the sort of candid record that we had before us. I knew at once this was going to be an unsanitized record when I saw the cardboard boxes that they brought out on the trolley in the Kennedy Library, because normally presidential materials are in what are distinctive presidential archive boxes, and these were just in raw cardboard boxes. It was clear to me that these papers had not been sorted or processed yet, and of course that's very exciting to the historian because it means nobody can sanitize them or pull anything out of it that they fear would be a sensitive revelation.
Okay, so you got access to the self-information. I find it fascinating. I know a lot of people do, but make the case that it's important as history.
Well, it's important to history because it seems to me it's terribly important for us to know the health history of presidents. Lots of presidents have had health problems which they've hidden from the public. Grover Cleveland had a cancer of the jaw. He was operated on in 1893 on a yacht on the East River off of Manhattan, and this was never known to the public. It wasn't revealed till 1917. Woodrow Wilson, the stroke, which incapacitated him. Essentially, Mrs. Wilson ran the government for roughly the last 18 months of the Wilson presidency. This was held back from the public. Franklin Roosevelt, 1944, in early 45 at the Yalta Conference, Winston Churchill's physician, Lord Moran, said, FDR is a dying man. He'll be dead in 3 months. He has hardening of the arteries of the brain. Roosevelt never should have run again in 1944. Kennedy's cover-up of his health problems in 1960. I don't think we'll ever want to do this again, to have a candidate for the presidency who has the extent of the health problems Kennedy had and took the kinds of and variety of medications he was on. Now, he made a bet, as I said earlier, and he succeeded. He carried it off. But shouldn't he have incorporated or included the public in that bet. He didn't. And so I think it's an important process that historians at least get to look at the health records of presidents. I, in general, am for privacy of medical records, but when it comes to presidents and the men who've had their fingers on the nuclear trigger, it seems to me we want to know as much as we possibly can about their physical and mental health. And it should be part of our consideration in deciding whether we want to cast a vote for that individual or not.
Well, Robert Dalek, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
Robert Dalek is the author of a new biography of John F. Kennedy called An Unfinished Life. The new documentary, Spellbound, tells the story of a group of young participants in the annual National Spelling Bee held in Washington, D.C. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg liked the film and has these thoughts on the curious institution of the spelling bee and its significance in American life.
Mark Twain claimed that the ability to spell well was an inborn talent like a photographic memory. If that's true, God seems to have distributed the gift pretty democratically, with no regard for more general intellectual capacities. Or at least that's what I like to think, being one of the mass of people who've never quite grasped the distinction between ible and ubble. But Americans have always placed a singular importance on spelling. In fact, the spelling bee was the original American game show. It was born in colonial times, when the attainment of correct spelling was regarded as a symbol of cultivation. Back then, the contests were called spelling schools or spelling matches. Horace Greeley reminisced fondly about his success as a spelling prodigy when he was a boy in New Hampshire around 1815. As he put it, spelling was a natural strength for a child of tenacious memory and no judgment. And whatever Mark Twain's reservations about the value of spelling, he prided himself on having been a champion speller as a youth in Missouri. By the mid-19th century, the contest had become an adult pastime as well. Bret Hart recounted a spelling competition in the California mining camps that ended in a fight with Bowie knives when two contestants disagreed over whether eiderduck began with an I or an E. The phrase spelling bee itself entered the language in the 1870s, when the competitions became a popular mass entertainment. More than 4,000 people attended one bee at the Philadelphia Academy of Music in 1875, and a disturbance broke out when the audience judged that one contestant had been unfairly eliminated for misspelling receipt. After a period of eclipse, the bees were revived again in the 1920s as a way of encouraging the civic virtues of literacy among schoolchildren. One enthusiast described them as an antidote to jazz and frivolity. The first national bee was held in 1925, and for the last 60 years, the event has been sponsored by Scripps Howard. Jeff Blitz's Spellbound is an engaging and surprisingly moving documentary that follows the fortunes of eight contestants in the 1999 National Bee held in Washington, D.C. Some of the kids are motivated by pure competitive spirit, but for most of them, the Bee stands for the struggle to move up and on in American life. Angela's a Texas girl whose father came to America from Mexico as an undocumented immigrant. He still speaks no English, and his trip to Washington to watch his daughter compete in the national seems to seal his life's accomplishment. Ashley is a black girl from the Washington, D.C. projects who describes herself as a prayer warrior. And Neil from San Clemente, California, is the son of a successful Indian immigrant with a boundless faith in the American dream. In America, the father says, if you work hard, you'll make it. The kids are all bright and winning and incredibly dedicated, and you feel their anguish as they're eliminated one after the other in a cruel prototype of Survivor. But while that experience would have been familiar to Greeley or Twain, this is not your father's spelling bee. Back in 1925, the contestants were given the sort of words that an ordinary literate citizen would be expected to know, items like promiscuous, intelligible, and fracas. In 1932, Dorothy Greenwald from Des Moines, Iowa, walked away with the laurels when she was able to spell knack. But like a lot of other competitive events, the spelling bee has become a lot more specialized and intense over the course of time. In recent years, the winning words in the national bee have included such bowerbird treasures as xanthosis, vivisepulture, euonym, succedaneum, and prospiciens. That inevitably changes the significance of the exercise, At this level, in fact, the competition isn't really about the capriciousness of English spelling. It has more to do with the indistinctness of English pronunciation, which merges P's and B's and T's and D's, and which reduces every unstressed vowel to a blurry O. That isn't much of an impediment when the word is one you already recognize, like intelligible or fracas. But it makes it impossible to pin down the spelling of an unfamiliar word, particularly when its derivation is obscure. In fact, I had the feeling that the pronouncer was often making an effort to keep the pronunciations as uninformative and ambiguous as possible. You can sense the contestants' perplexity as the pronouncer feeds them words like apocope, hellebore, clavicin, and allegar, items that most people can happily live their lives without ever encountering. Occasionally, the kids' faces brighten when they recognize a word that happens to be on their cram lists, but usually they're reduced to mere guessing. I felt a special sympathy for the kid who was eliminated when he blew obsomath, a word for somebody who begins learning late in life. O-B-S-O, he started, but the correct spelling was O-P-S-I. Opsi, that's the Greek word for late, as anyone will know who recognizes the connection to that other household word, opsigamy. Still, even if spelling isn't a very good indicator of intellectual capacity, you have no doubt that most of the kids profiled in Spellbound will succeed in later life. America still rewards dedication and hard work, just as it did in Horace Greeley's day. And the modern spelling bee rewards something else as well. You have to have an instinct for understanding indistinct commands to perform arbitrary and often pointless acts and somehow figure out what's expected of you. In today's America, that's another talent that serves you well.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University, and he's the author of The Way We Talk Now. The documentary Spellbound opened at the Film Forum in New York and will be playing in theaters around the country. Coming up, music critic Milo Miles on the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. This is Fresh Air. The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival began the same year Woodstock was held, 1969. But while the legend of the big festival now seems impossibly distant, the little local festival has become a vibrant, ongoing institution. Keeping such an operation going for almost 35 years requires more than luck. Music critic Milo Miles went to this year's festival a couple of weeks ago and has been thinking about why its mix of musical acts keeps attracting big crowds.
It's tough to shock people these days, but when I would tell folks who had been to the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival that I had never been there, they were shocked. Now that I've thrown away my Jazz Fest virginity, I can see what the shouting was about. The mix of ages and ethnicities in the audience is unmatched, and Cesar Rosas of Los Lobos got it right when he called out, "Hello, music lovers." Because I've never seen such large crowds devoted to hearing concerts first and foremost. Attendance was down for the second year in a row, but really, there were just enough people there to keep the line short and the outdoor stages halfway visible. The sound was outstanding, and delays or schedule glitches were rare. The best trick, though, is presenting a lineup that's as varied but coherent as the Jazz Fest managed to do. The steam heat of New Orleans has made the styles of music native to the area melt and flow together. Jazz, blues, zydeco, R&B, Cajun, swamp pop. But it's no secret that for about 30 years now, New Orleans hasn't been producing major acts as regularly as it once did. The Marsalis family won't keep Jazz Fest vital by themselves. So what's new that keeps the heels kicking high?
A leg by me, I'm the O.S.C.A. A leg by me, the Bayon, the Les Marpensé. A leg by Cabrillo, O.S.C.A. A leg by me, I'm the Les Marpensé. A leg by Cabrillo.
In the last 10 years, two trends have lifted the Jazz and Heritage Festival: a savvy selection of big-name attractions and the popularity of so-called jam bands. The stars that fit into Jazz Fest are more varied than you might think. Although I have almost opposite feelings about them, Lucinda Williams and Ben Harper are natural adds. Bob Dylan has obvious roots connections, but so do the OJs. As for those acts who do not belong, like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, well, it's much easier to avoid shows at Jazz Fest than to catch them. The popularity of jam bands at Jazz Fest is both predictable and problematic. Years ago, the group Blues Traveler was a hit at Jazz Fest and started the trend. Well-known jam bands like Fish and Widespread Panic still play the fest. Trouble is, jam band stuff is music based on music rather than well-grounded cultural traditions, and I have trouble with any style that rambles on so willfully. But Jazz Fest has outlasted many trends in the past, and as LL Cool J's performance confirmed, hip-hop groups that understand R&B basics, like De La Soul and The Roots, should become staples of future Jazz Fests, and there will always be a few sharp new people playing the blues. But perhaps the best way to explain the enduring appeal of Jazz Fest is to use a handy rule that combines taste and ear. The finest New Orleans music and food build from clear, basic ingredients that tickle and tingle. You can listen to recordings of New Orleans funk and eat northern imitations of Cajun and Creole cuisine. And that's all right. But if you hear the music and eat the food in the place where they're at home, only then do you know what it means to miss New Orleans.
Milo Miles is a music critic based in Cambridge.
This time I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm walking to New Orleans. I'm gonna need to parachute when I get through walking these blues. Get back to New Orleans.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Vintage Books, publishers of the new paperback by Robert Caro, Master of the Senate, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, children's book writer Owen Colfer, author of the Artemis Fowl series, about a 12-year-old millionaire criminal mastermind. And Sean Foley and Hamish McCall tell us about their new Broadway hit comedy, The Play What I Wrote. Join us for the next Fresh Air.